Hello and welcome. My name is John August.
My name is Craig Mazin.
And this is episode 743 of Script Notes. It's a podcast about screenwriting and things that are interesting to screenwriters. Craig, today on the show, I want to discuss setting and character movement with a writer whose show must be setting records for the number of characters and locations per episode. Ryan Condal is the co-creator and showrunner of House of the Dragon, which has just started its third season on HBO. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks for having me, guys. This is very exciting. I listened to you. I still listen to you at points, but I was a deep, heavy listener when you first launched, when I feel like there were like five podcasts. And now there are, you know, 13 million. But thank you for the service that you do to our writing community.
Oh, well, thank you. And this is great to talk to you in this format, because you and I have spoken many times, but it's always been under the context of, hey, this person you were using, or hey, what do you think of this director? So it's we've been helping each out, you know, over the course of the last few years, but it's nice to be able to talk about stuff that is not that, but just craft.
Craft, yeah. Also, as the one person on this Zoom who does not have a highly successful HBO show, I just want to ask some questions and learn from the two of you about doing this. I want to talk about your show, obviously, showrunning, but also your unusual path to becoming a showrunner, because it's not what you would expect in terms of just like starting in trenches and moving up. It seemed quick, but also you started in the process later, which is going to be very hopeful news for, I think, a lot of our listeners, that you didn't show up in Los Angeles at 21 and PA on a set. You went in through a different route.
Yeah, I was working in marketing and advertising. I'd always wanted to be a screenwriter. I was the weird kid that knew I wanted to be a professional writer when I was like, mm-hmm. you know, 12 or 13. And then at some point, I had a really great humanities teacher in high school who had worked in the development world, I think with Disney, and taught us sort of three-act structure. And this is back in the 1990s, just as like Netscape Navigator was coming online. Yeah. So all of this stuff was not readily accessible the way it is now. And he broke down Star Wars in the three-act structure and sort of taught us the Joseph Campbell, you know, Hero with 10,000 Faces thing alongside of it. And it just broke my brain because I was such a huge movie fan. But I think at the time, I, you know, as many people do, thought it was the directors and the actors mm-hmm. sort of making it all up and didn't realize there was a craft involved with that. And then I was like, well, forget novels. This is exactly what I want to do. So like Craig, I grew up in New Jersey. I did not have any way into the business. So I just tried to learn everything I could with books and by buying screenplays off those tables in New York City.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And then I found Terry Rossio's Word Player.
I remember that site, yeah.
Blog. And
I think it's still there.
It's great. And it's a great resource. Still is a great resource. I printed all those out, put them in a binder. And then I just started writing screenplays, feature screenplays, specs, and working in, I had a business degree, so I worked in media advertising, then pharmaceutical advertising, and just kept writing it. I wrote at night, and then eventually got my company to move me to LA, and I kept writing at night. And eventually, number 13, my 13th spec, I sold just after the 2007 writer's strike.
I want to go through all of that because I also want to dig into sort of like more what you were doing like while you were doing copywriting for a pharmaceutical company, like because it's related. That's actually sort of similar to sort of my story and like a path that I was going to take if I hadn't sort of ended up in film school. So I want to dig into more of that because I think it's very relevant for a lot of our listeners in terms of how do you make the most of what you can do where you are and how do you learn from that. But also at a certain point, you gotta jump and make the move to the town that does what you want to do. And in our bonus interview for premium members, I want to talk about dragons overall, because Craig and I play Dungeons & Dragons every week. There's a lot of dragons in the world. The dragons in your show are very, very specific and move beyond sort of what we were used to from the original series. So I want to talk about dragons and sort of their use in your world, but also dragons as probably the most depicted on-screen creatures that don't actually exist in the world and what it is about dragons that makes them so appealing.
They exist.
They exist.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In us, there are two dragons.
And by the way, I also was working in advertising.
That's right.
Oh, great. I didn't know that.
And copywriting. Yeah, it was for a company that made promos for CBS shows. So it was sort of like, you know, entertainment adjacent. And in a weird way, the closer you get to entertainment through advertising, the worse it is. Like, I would much rather have been trying to sell pills than bad sitcoms. But, you know, I've always said, and I'm curious if you had the same experience, that one thing that advertising taught was concision, because they said you have 30 seconds, really 28.2 seconds to tell a story, beginning, middle, and end, with a point.
Yeah.
And it has to somehow stick in people's heads. That was a skill that I still, I'm not sure I actively use it, but I think I passively use it all the time. Curious if you still feel that, the siren call of the concision of advertising.
For sure. And I worked in specifically print advertising, so on the professional side. So whereas you were entertainment adjacent, I was basically the creative person that was as far away from entertainment as possible. If the first creative job that's furthest away from entertainment, that's where I was. So I was doing direct to professional, direct to doctor advertising, this highly technical science driven stuff. But for me, it was extremely creative. And I worked on both sides because I have an accounting and an economics degree.
Sure. Why not?
Because my parents wanted me to get a real job, which thank you. I understood why. So I actually started in account services. So I started as Pete Campbell and then desperately wanted to make my way over to become a Peggy. Mm-hmm. So that it took years, but I eventually made my way over there. So I had seen it from both sides, but it is really important. And it's even more so when you're not in a filmed medium, because you basically have an image and a headline, or maybe a headline and a tagline. Yeah, but it's basically matching words to images in a way that they work in harmony, but they're not, it's not saying the same thing. You're not showing people a picture and then saying what the picture is. It's lateral thinking to try to tell a whole story in a still image and arrest people and stop them as they're flipping through their medical journal or their prescription pad or whatever.
My advertising degree was in Drake University, Des Moines, Iowa. And so the local businesses there were a lot of like agriculture advertising. And so like, how do you talk to farmers about this new seed, this new product? And I really enjoyed the classes I was in, but quickly realized like, man, I don't want to do this for a living. Because you would see people who were like winning the local advertising awards. And it's like, they were so happy to get the award, but like, I did not want that life. But I loved the classes I was in. I loved the graphic design of it all. I loved the really precision copywriting and recognizing who your audience is, what are they expecting, how do you surprise them, how do you deliver what they need to hear. And I think it's also relevant to the business we all ended up in. You're working with a team. And so you might be the copywriter, but there's an art director, there's a creative director, there's an account executive, there's the client. And there's clear parallels to everything we deal with in terms of here's the studio, here's the director, here's the producers. And it's making sure they all feel heard, but also that the thing you're delivering makes sense and is the best work possible. And that's a skill you develop just from practice. And I was lucky to have a lot of practice in those, you know, couple of years in college.
Yeah, and you also, as you move up, I moved up, I think I worked in advertising for 7 years before I eventually broke in. So I'd move it up. I was like a mid-level person, but I had like a group with me and I had to go out and pitch.
Yeah.
And pitch these places that definitely wanted an ad campaign, but they didn't necessarily want you.
Yeah.
So that experience set me up in a way that I didn't even realize until I went into my first pitch. Because, you know, you sell a spec, you work your whole life to just write something that people want to buy, and then you do it. And then the next job you get, you have to do this entirely different skill that you haven't learned. And then it's actually contra to everything that makes you want to be a writer, where you want to sit in a room by yourself and not have to talk to anybody. And then suddenly you have to go in and sweat it out and explain your ideas to people who are not necessarily dying to buy your thing. So all that stuff really lined up. And you make a great point, John, about the collaboration of working in a team. And it's so similar, right? The art director, the creative director is sort of the director. The account executive is like the studio executive. The copywriter is kind of the writer. You have editors. You have traffic coordinators that are moving things around the set.
You have media buyers who are very much like the, like, you know, the exhibition people. So,
exactly. Yeah.
So there's a skill that you learn along the way that, like I said, I was doing the same thing. And you did this too. You transitioned into feature film writing. And that's where John and I were feature film writers, and John still is doing both. And feature film writing can be very solo. Mm-hmm. It's very monk-like. Eventually, once the thing gets made, it's like an advertising agency where they weirdly tell the copywriter to go away.
Yeah.
It's the stupidest ad agency ever. When you come around to writing television, you begin to work with Carlton Cuse, and you're working on Colony. And I presume, because Carlton Cuse is a traditional television drama developer that there was a room, that there was a writer's room, that there were people in there. And I know for sure that on House of the Dragon, you have a writer's room. And I'm super curious about this because I continued my monk-like deal for Chernobyl and for The Last of Us. But in looking ahead to what I do next, I'm not only for a change of pace, but for creative necessity, I know I'm going to need a big, large room. I would love to hear from you how you use a room to your advantage, what the challenges are of a room, especially when we're dealing with a story this big, because the temptation might be, I need to focus all of these thousands of plot lines and people through one mental lens. But you also need all of these people to generate all of these different points of view because there are so many characters. You can't write that. I'm going to show that basically he's writing two characters at a time. I could do it. So talk me through the pluses, the minuses, the values and strengths and the challenges and the wins of a big old writer's room. Teach me.
I mean, it was definitely something that I had to learn. I mean, I was only a feature writer for 5 years. And I was working. I managed somehow to like work that whole time. And look, 2011 was a pretty lean year, but I reported income every quarter. I worked getting polishes and rewrites and other jobs. I mean, people liked me and I was cheap also. So I would get hired to do a lot of
great combo.
Yeah, absolutely. Talented and cheap. Yeah, they love that.
First drafts, lots of first drafts. And then I ended up signing with WME. I changed agencies and I was looking for a new features agent, and my TV agent now, Ryan Drazen, and then Teresa Kang, who's now still in the business but no longer an agent, came in and they were like, we want to make you a showrunner. And I was like, what? Because I had been writing in all this kind of big genre stuff. So they're like, we see you as a creator. So they put me out during pilot season. I pitched NBC on this property they had that Carlton was attached to. It's called The Sixth Gun. And we sold a pilot. And then I wrote a pilot and they really liked it. And then they made it. And the reason you've never seen the TV show is because they made it and then they threw it away.
Well, that's a classic pilot. I have those too. You got the experience of learning how to make a show and how to take something you've written in your head and actually produce it. By this point, had you had features produced? Had you had Hercules or...
And that Hercules stuff that... went into production while we were filming Six Guns. So that was a pretty great... 2013 was a pretty great year because that was finally like after... It felt like I'd been wandering the desert for, you know, 6 years, but it all kind of happened. And further Craig Mazin crossovers with Ryan Condal, number 6 on the call sheet in my pilot was Pedro Pascal. Should have been number 1 on the call sheet, maybe. And then maybe we'd have a television show and you and I would both have very different careers. But
You know what? Even Dan and Dave had him at number 105 on the call sheet. You know, it took him a little while there.
He knew I was a massive fan of Game of Thrones. And because we talked a lot about all this stuff. And then about 6 months after the show had gone away, he called me out of the blue and he was like, I'm up for Game of Thrones. I need to take you out to lunch. I need to know everything that you know. So we sat down and we chatted. And then at some point he just sent me a picture of him in like wushu spear training. And I was like, this is insane. Pedro Pascal. It's crazy.
He was always Pedro Pascal.
Yes.
Sixth Gun was a pilot that you shot, but you didn't have a room for that, right? That was still just you writing a thing. And so it wasn't the next show that you actually had to have a room, correct?
Correct. I had the depressing experience of hiring a writer's room for The Sixth Gun and then not calling anybody into work. Because it's also run and gun that they make you do all that stuff if it gets picked up so you're ready to go.
Yeah,
and then it didn't. So I had a test of interviewing and reading writers for the first time and all that.
But it comes to fruition when you and Carlton get Colony on the air.
Yes, correct.
So now you've got to walk me through this. Like it is a rare thing that when we talk to people, their lessons are important for me. Like they're either parallel to me or things that I would never, they're just different genres or different kinds of modalities. But this is like, I'm going to need to do this on my next show.
Yeah.
Help me, talk me through building a room and running a room and how you and your vision and I guess we'll just call it primacy as the showrunner interacts with the material as you go.
I just went out looking for the best samples that I could find. I mean, that's sort of where I started. It was definitely a process I refined over time. I think I went into it kind of assuming that, well, you know, everybody here is a professional writer. I think the tone of the show is rather apparent on the page. It's the Nazi occupation of Paris, except it's modern day Los Angeles and the Nazis are aliens and we never see them. And we deal with the Vichy government, which are the evil human collaborators who have decided to work with the aliens against the humans, against their own interests. But it was much trickier than that. And that first season was pretty fraught, just trying to, because the pilot had a certain tone to it, but then we had to expand the story. And I knew where I wanted to go with it generally, but I don't know that I had, you know, we did 10 episodes in the first season. After that, it was actually 13 in seasons two and three. Mm-hmm. So learning how to break some, because I was so, my brain was so wired for three act structure,
right,
you know, 120 pages, to try to expand out to, you know, to doing that and making also individual episodes within it. There was a lot of trial and error, and we didn't have a ton of time with when they wanted on the air. So the first season was very fraught, but I went out and tried to hire the best writers that I could. I tried to get a bunch of different people from different backgrounds with different experience. And look, they all came to the room with really interesting stuff. It was also going through an experience of figuring out what USA wanted for the show, because we knew NBC Universal wanted it. We expected Sci-Fi was going to pick it up because that's where all the sci-fi shows were. But this is in the Mr. Robot period when they were like, you know.
Mm-hmm. We're no longer blue sky crime shows. We're, a new thing.
Exactly. But also trying to figure out what they wanted, you know, to put on the air and all that. So it was really just trying to read the best samples I could. I did a lot of background research, calling people that they had worked with previously. I mean, we did deal a little bit with budget stuff in terms of writer budget because it was a basic cable network. Mm-hmm. So the rates are such and this and that. So I actually hired a bunch of people that didn't have a ton of experience because I was trying to, you know, find the undrafted free agent.
The economic.
In the rough.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Reading samples. Let's talk about that because that's something you've had to do now for all the shows that you do. And I don't know if this is the case, but even going from season to season to season of House of the Dragon, some writers may drop off to go do other things and you may want to bring in. So you're never really probably stop going through this process. When you pick up a script to read, typically they are not spec scripts. I think that's probably not a thing that people do anymore.
There are still a few of those left. We've had some people on recently talking about like actually still loving to read spec scripts because it's a chance to see that someone can write in another writer's voice and tone. Yeah.
Do you still get those for maybe for House of the Dragon?
I never did. Agree with John. I think everybody should go back and do it. I know it's never going to monetize itself because nobody buys specs anymore. Yeah, but right. I just think that that's actually the best way to show that you can ape somebody else's thing.
Style, right.
Yeah, I was reading plays. I was reading a lot of features, TV pilots, basically all original material.
Got it.
And at some point, I read a short story that somebody submitted.
And as you go through that process, how long do you read? Typically, if you're on page two and you're not like immediately like, woohoo, how far do you go, in all honesty?
Well, so at the beginning, great question, Craig. At the beginning, I was like, well, this is my job and I have to like read it until page 58.
Uh-huh.
Now it's much more just looking to be hooked and get some, have somebody convince you to stay on from page five and then page 10. And then much, I think, the way a studio would go through reading a submission.
There's just too many submissions to...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just looking for somebody that can write and that can surprise you and delight you and deliver complex ideas in a simple way, write great characters, write interesting scenes. Because you don't need, I mean, look, it would be great to fill a room with, you know, the quote unquote five tool player across the board. But really, you need a bunch of people in the room that can break story, move story along in the room and be tireless in just pitching. And then you need a few draft writers. I mean, it'd be great if you had all draft writers, but you need a few people that can write a draft that then you can rewrite. Because in most cases, you're going to want to go in and...
You have to do what you do.
Yeah, just to put it in the voice of the show. And also at some point, you're just in production and there's budget and actor notes coming in and whatever, and you just have to take over and do it. So at first, I was trying to just... basically drafts the, you know, 1927 New York Yankees right out of the gate. And then I got much more easy on myself after that, where it's just, you know, just trying to find, this writer has a ton of experience. This writer's done a show like this before. This writer knows, you know, I have this writer, T. McKell, in the room, who is like a scholar of A Song of Ice and Fire.
A lore master.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. You need some lore masters. And how do you determine who your drafters are. Do they all know at the beginning, or do you kind of, as you break the story, you sort of go, okay, I'm going to have you write a script and you write a script?
Yeah. I mean, they reveal themselves through the writing process. I will say I was very lucky in both cases. On Colony, I had this wonderful writer that I worked with, Wes Took. He was the most senior level person in season one and then just became kind of my writing partner throughout. And this is the way I've pursued my shows from there. It's just something that works really well for me to have a senior writer who essentially, we do everything together because the show is so busy. It's you and me. And then on House of the Dragon, it's Sarah Hess, who her first job was on Deadwood with David Milch.
And fine Sarah. Yeah.
And she had gotten her MFA in, I think, dramatic writing. And she just thought that writer's rooms were the brilliant, uber genius writer would just lie on the floor in the writer's room and then just dictate Shakespearean dialogue to everybody and you'd furiously write it down. So she had very different experiences after that. But she worked on House and Orange is the New Black. I mean, she's amazing, you know. For me, once I had that, then it's sort of like, well, everything else is kind of a bonus. And I had that with Wes on Colony. So people would kind of come in out of the room, but Wes was with me all three seasons. And then with Sarah, we've had a similar experience. There was a lot of turnover after season one. Actually, one of those writers, Ira Parker, went on to create A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms.
Yes.
A terrific writer, and actually tried to get him to come help us produce season one, but it was COVID and they were like trying to have children. And so he's like, I'm afraid to come to Europe. So it worked out great for him and great for the franchise. And then, and now in season three to season four, we basically have the same writing staff. So, whatever I've done, you know, Sarah and I have managed to, you know, craft this really nice thing that we have, and we love it. It works really, really well right now. But answering your previous question about the draft writers, they reveal themselves through the writing process. I mean, that's the glory of it. It's like to the TV writers out there that are trying to do this for a job, you can be the lowest person on the totem pole. And in that first draft, you can be a hero to the showrunner.
Yeah.
And all we want is somebody to deliver that thing that needs, you know, a little polish, better if you can take the notes and make it better, then you're like, we'll put a cape on you.
Yeah. The story of showrunning is you're surrounded by thousands of people who are desperate to help you, and almost all of them are hurting you. they don't even know it. They're trying. They want to help. They're just, something's wrong in what they're doing and it's hurting. And then when you find somebody who wants to help you, who helps you, it is, you cling to that person. You
do not let go.
Do not let go.
Yeah.
Craig, I'm realizing a meta thing that's happening here is you're asking very questions about, like, you know, how to run a writer's room and stuff like that. And like, Craig, we've talked about this on the show so many times, and a lot of listeners are probably voicing this. And it's because it's usually episodes that I'm just talking to a showrunner where you're not here. And so we'll put together a playlist of like just me asking these questions, because every showrunner has similar but different answers. And so I'm thinking back, Jack Schaefer talking about how she sort of casts a writer's room. Basically, she knows what she's really strong at, and she knows what she's lacking in terms of what she needs for herself to have the best chance at making this show. So who are the writers that she's going to be able to bring in that can help her in her weaknesses, both as writers, but also, this is what I'd like to write about, is that what you need in the room, because it's great to read these writers, but then you meet with them and then you sort of do the background checks, and you must be thinking about, like, how is this going to gel in the room? And how much are you physically in a room together? How much is it virtual? What does your writer's room actually even look like?
We're very old school. I mean, I'm all in person. I can't do that virtual stuff. I drift off. I just can't. I mean, I can have like a meeting on Zoom, like a story meeting, but I can't break story on it. It just drives me crazy. And we were lucky with the way House of the Dragon sort of fell. I remember our last sort of ominous conversations in the room were all about this weird virus that was spreading around. And my Spanish scout for all of our locations in season one was over the first week of March in 2020. At some point, HBO called while we were out there, and they're like, you need to stop going to airports. And I was like, well, what does that mean? How are we going to get home? And I was like, no, you can go to that airport. Just don't go to any of the other airports. So we just got in a van, and then in a closed air van with everybody breathing on each other, and drove around and did scouts that way. So, but we were able to be in person. We weren't forced to, because by the time the season two room came around, everybody was vaccinated and had to be vaccinated to be around. And then we kind of got on with it. So it was a very old school room, corkboard and cards. I like the physical satisfaction of finishing an episode and being able to put all those cards together in a neat little binder stack and taking them off and putting them on and moving them around on the board. I like all that sensory stuff.
What would be on a card for this? Like, how many words is on a card? Is it just describing a scene? Is it describing a beat? Like, what does a card look like in this big writer's room corkboard?
It's usually beats, but a beat usually is a scene in the way that we break TV. Rhaenyra does a thing. Damon brings Rhaenyra her crown. Everybody kneels to her. You know, that sort of thing. Because you want to be able to read it from wherever you're sitting in the room. And the writer's assistant sits there and keeps all of them kind of cataloged and then writes all the bullets that are informing the scene beneath it. We really try to break everything out as detailed as possible so that when the writer sits down with the outline, they know basically all the slug lines that are going into the script, the order that they're going in, at least on that first pass. And then here is what the scene is about. This is where it begins. These are who are in it. This is where it ends. This is the dramatic experience that we're taking the audience through in this scene. This is whose POV it is, et cetera.
How long is that outline that the writer is going off with?
Well, we give them a room break, essentially. So the writer's assistant has a room break outline, and that's maybe, I don't know, maybe 6, 7, 8 pages. Okay. And then they come back with like a 10 to 13 page sort of Microsoft Word, not final draft, but like a prose.
A plan.
It's like putting flesh on the skeleton. It's just that's a layer of flesh. And then the first draft is a layer of flesh.
Yeah.
And then you just keep concentric circles of detail.
And when that outline draft comes back or when the first draft comes back, is that a thing that is discussed in the room, or is that just a thing between you and the writer? What happens with that draft?
Sometimes it just depends on, unfortunately, with the way this particular show is made, and Craig knows this, I'm never doing one thing at one time. Yeah. Everybody thinks that because Craig and I make shows that take 2 years between seasons, they imagine that there's like 6 months of work and then it's 18 months of us just like walking our dogs and just thinking of ideas and all that.
But that sounds nice.
Yeah. No, it's Fallujah the whole time. So we are usually breaking story in that phase while we're in the teeth of the first cuts and posts. So I have two offices in London and I just kind of run between them. So it kind of depends on what's going on at the moment, but half of my day goes to post, half of my day goes to meeting with the writers. Generally what we do is everybody reads the draft, but then it's Sarah and I reading it, taking a meeting between the two of us, making sure that we're going to give cohesive notes together to the writer, sitting with the writer, giving them notes and then sending them off. But at the end, I like to sort of, okay, here's where we are with all the scripts. You know, Sarah and I have done a pass, or I've done a pass, or Sarah's done a pass. It's gone into the network. Here's the first two episodes. Here's the first four. Let's get together and talk about them. Does anybody have any concern? We do a lot of that, but I know in the network model, there is a lot of the whole room reads the scripts. There's notes, especially in like comedy and things like that, where looking for better jokes and punchier things and all that.
Yeah, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, like Elaine classically, she would project it on the wall and just like go through line by line and look for all jokes and things like that. That's a very classic way to do that. And because you are preparing to shoot this show and you're probably shooting multiple episodes at once and you're cross-boarding, and that's not realistic to do all the time. My question is the room running all the time while the show is shooting? Because at a certain point, I imagine the room wraps, but you still have episodes left to shoot.
No, so all of the scripts have to be done. Like, season 4, we have essentially written, already. HBO will have all of the drafts this summer, first drafts, for our first drafts that we're choosing to share with the network. So it's probably like the sixth draft.
Yeah.
But we won't start production until, early next year, early 2027, because the schedule is such a Jenga tower. Everything is scheduled to sort of set and location and all that. And the budget is just, schedule affects the budget and all that. So my producer actually has to sit with all of this stuff this summer and build it into a schedule and a plan. And when are we going to be in this country? Or when are we going to be in this country? And because we shoot everything out of order, it just all needs to be. So by the time, it's really nice because by the time filming starts, that's the only time where we're doing one thing, which is just covering set, doing production.
You sure you don't want to do what I do?
Oh my God, Craig.
Why don't you do what I do? It's so much more interesting.
Yeah.
Don't have all of your scripts written. Just have a plan for the season. Write like three scripts. Start shooting. Know that you have 6 more scripts to write while you're shooting.
Yeah.
And directing. it really, I'm telling you, it keeps you alive.
Yeah. Like, that spark.
Yeah.
I have such anxiety that like the very idea of that would just paralyze me. Like,
guess what?
I
have that anxiety too. And it's still this way. But this is why, you know, John's right. There's been many, many showrunners on, and there are certain stock questions that I suppose a showrunner will be asked about rooms, but I particularly go, okay, well, here's a guy mm-hmm. who makes a big fantasy epic at HBO. And if all things go well, my next show is going to be a big fantasy epic at HBO.
You're going to be doing one of those.
I'm really interested in this.
Yeah.
So you have all the scripts done mm-hmm. before you start shooting.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a dream to me and probably a dream to everybody.
We, of course, rewrite while...
Naturally.
You'll rewrite a scene. You'll realize you need a scene and then do it. You can make little moves.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
At least the network and the budget planners, they have everything there. On the way, when you're getting these scripts from your collaborators, you mentioned you're going to probably do a pass on them. You're going to rewrite some of them. How do you manage when... you have to mildly rewrite somebody, that's nice, or, we sort of just kind of rewrote it. Is that an expected situation? I'm curious how, especially because your show is so much about politics, mm-hmm. How you manage the politics of situations like that in rooms.
I just go for as much a kind honesty as much as possible. I just think there are showrunners that don't address it at all. And then that's weird. I think there are people that try to kind of address it and soft shoe it. And then they read the draft and it's nothing, you know, there's not a line in it that they've written. I just try to have an honest conversation with the writers. And it's like, look, this is it's a very specific world. It's a very specific syntax. I'm weird and specific myself. This is what I had to do. Read it. If you want to talk about it, we can talk about it. I always assure them, this does not mean that you are not a great writer. That's why I hired you. I try to do as much of that as possible. I mean, really, we have gotten to a point with the show, thankfully, where one of the other writers beyond Sarah and I has been with us since he helped us cover set in season one. So he started writing in season two, but he got to like learn the show by being a covering producer in season one. He had come out of the British television system. His name is David Hancock. Thank you, David. And people know the system now and they know what to expect. And a lot of times what I will do is do the heavy kind of rewrite. The studio reads it, whatever. And then once we get into the play, because where I will be in the fall is we're going to be doing HBO notes and sort of production notes. And we have to cut this because of budget and whatever. I will tend to hand the drafts back to the writers once we're doing more targeted mm-hmm. stuff. And I feel actually my experience has been, I've been much more successful getting back what we need when it's more micro, when you're not looking at the whole forest,
right.
when you're just
right.
looking at a tree.
Makes sense.
And I also have Sarah, which is awesome because like a lot of times I'm doing the production, pre-production stuff and whatever, and she's doing the, can you please do this scene or do a scene where this thing happens? And
can you send me Sarah, please? Can I have her now?
Craig, actually, she's in an HBO deal.
Interesting. So that means she's literally free to HBO. I understand what you're saying. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
She's available in like a year. So
no.
So,
yeah. All right. What about you leave her there?
Yes.
And you come over and you hang out with me.
Dude, I kind of want to do that as my next job. I sort of want to be the
right-hand man.
Number two. I want to be the right hand. We're like, what can I do? How can I be your hero where I can go home and sleep at night?
I have talked about this with Justin Marks a bit.
And not get balder.
Yeah, exactly. Justin is making Shogun season two while we're making The Last of Us season three. And his offices are right below ours same lot. So every now and then we just walk over and complain to each other about our lives, which is great. And there is this strange desire to either... yes, not be in charge, or their fantasies about just being murdered. Then you don't have to finish.
Look, it's a dark place.
It's a hard job. It is a hard job. When I look at your show, just watching the first episode of this season.
Yeah, well, we should talk about that. The naval battle is just like, come on.
Okay, thank you.
I watch this, and here's my curse. I am enjoying this thing, mm-hmm. and I am in awe of this thing. And then there's this third part of my mind that's like, oh no, the meetings, the amount of meetings. Just for that shot, there were meetings. that's, and I just feel for you.
Which scenes actually have to be on the water versus which things are going to be just blue screens? Just like, yeah. Ugh. Yeah.
The,
yeah.
just the, okay, yeah. When he falls through, like the special effects guys are like, we can practically have the wood go or do it. And it's like, there's 4 yeah. million effing mm-hmm. meetings. Mm-hmm. It is exhausting. That episode looked like there were many meetings.
There, yeah, so we stole it from original Game of Thrones, but original Game of Thrones called it Game of Meetings.
All right,
because yeah. that was what pre-production was, and
worst novel ever.
We're House of the Meetings, but yes, it's you have your 8 episodes, and then each a set piece that's that size, like the Battle of the Gullet, and we have a number of those this season. Those become episodes unto themselves, yeah. and they have yeah. their own production meetings and kind of their own office staff that sort of follows them around and notes them. Because even with that, like you can't, as you know, you can't be in multiple places at a time. And sometimes you're off in a different country filming that day. And they're, because prep continues all the way through the production. That was first up. So that luckily we did all of that before we right. started. We did the prep for it before we started shooting. But yeah, it's a lot.
It's intense. It's yeah. intense. And so much of what is difficult about making a show like yours is that you have the work of putting this down on paper. And I presume you have the same experience I have, that the more you do this, the more you realize you can't put enough detail on the page. Every time you write a yeah. little extra detail, you saved yourself a meeting, but you can't make a 900-page script. So you're looking for that balance. And then there is this brutal process of, okay, how are we going to do this? And sometimes it gets in my head when I'm writing, where I'll start to write something and go, okay, well, then how are we going to do this? And how many, and then I'm like, no,
that's not your responsibility.
Let's, yeah. you know what? Yeah. I get one chance to write my draft and everybody gets it and people go, wow. And then someone goes, we can't do it. And then yeah. I'm like, okay, now we can discuss maybe what we can. But I wonder, as you've gone along in response to budget realities and just the logistics of doing things, has that leaked back into the writing process at all?
For sure, because I just want to save myself time. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of breaking of the big set pieces. We try to break them out ahead of time in a way that, like, you want to preserve that creative experience. Going back to me as the 12-year-old, I am one of those weird writers that actually still really enjoys sitting in front of final draft. It's actually my like happy place mm-hmm. within the craziness of making the show. And it's probably because I just get to be alone, and it's the only place where I'm not being asked a question.
Right? Yeah.
But I do enjoy that kind of monastic pursuit, because it is it's such a small facet now of this massive thing mm-hmm. that takes 2 years to make. You really only, write a first draft for, I don't know, a few weeks out yeah. of that entire 2-year cycle. So I really do like, but I, just because it's so complicated, we try to actually break it out in the room first and then talk about sort of production methodology and what is this and what, and talking with my producer. And my producer and production designer are basically they take a few months off sort of during the teeth of post, but they're basically on 18 months out of the two-year cycle. So they're very accessible. So I can talk to them about, is this a thing that we can make? Is this a thing that you think we can mm-hmm. do? And figuring out that stuff in advance. And of course you rewrite it a million times as you get into the making of the show. Like with the Gullet, we did this, Lonnie Peristeer, the director, who's actually a neighbor of yours right now, because he's, you're in Vancouver, right?
Yes. I mean, well, not
yeah.
physically at the moment, but 2 weeks okay. from now, yes, back to Vancouver.
Yes. Yes. So he's up working in Vancouver right now, making big television. And he and I talked about this. He had worked on the previous season, so I knew this. He was going to do this episode. So we talked about it for months going into it, production methodology and all that. And then through pre-production, he actually made this thing that we ended up calling the supercut, which was like basically a really fancy animatic that was previs with the dragons. So it's pre-animation storyboards that he had a storyboard artist like cut and like film almost like a Ken Burns documentary mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to try to put movement into the storyboard. Sometimes it was just slug lines from the script, but just to understand the structure of the battle.
Yeah.
And then we ended up rewriting. We found a whole bunch of this stuff, the individual ideas works, but how are we intercutting all of this so it feels like you're building and building and building? Yeah. So we actually like edited the sequence before we ever even made it with this multimedia kind of thing, shared the supercut with all of the crew so that everybody knew what we were making. And honestly, it's like, I don't know why it took until the third season to do it with one of the, and we always have previs with the dragon sequences and all that, because they have to know exactly where the dragon is, what it's doing, because that's how they program the moving saddle and the camera moves and all that. It's all programmed to what's going on in the previs. But the stuff with the ships and the guys fighting on the deck, like that's stuff that you tend to figure out, you know, sort of closer to the day when you're actually going to shoot it. Some of it gets figured out on the day. So we were able to rewrite the sequence and put in story beats and cleverly disguised explainy dialogue and things like that. So you knew where you were going. And it was just, it was such a wonderful thing to have, because otherwise I would have gone into filming that sequence in a total, I mean, I went into the filming that sequence in a total state of terror, because we spent so much money on it and everybody was waiting for it and so much was riding on it. Yeah. But I knew what it was going to be in the end and I could see it. And I just knew that as long as it's in the little video monitor, like we have it and we can go make this thing. And and sure enough, I mean, when I'm more clear of it, I want to go and watch the supercut again, because I'd love to see how close it is to the final thing that we did.
It's a hell of a thing, I will say. Like, I texted Franny, who is our collective boss over there at HBO Drama, and I was like, now, because you know, we had a pretty big battle sequence in season two.
I felt pretty good
about that. And then
was on the water. Wasn't with boats.
No. Yeah,
no flying creatures.
Nah. And then I saw this thing. But I will say we do have a sequence. It's very different in nature. Yeah. But
stuff's coming.
I'll say, you guys, really, the bar is so high. Just first of all, you know, the amount of people that watch your show is just insane. It remains insane, which is great, because, you know, over the course of time, these big shows, you know, will start to slough viewers away. And you guys still are just absolutely crushing it. And the quality of the storytelling is so evident. And also the quality of the craft. Because I'm also, you know, I'm sitting there looking for bad comps. Like, that's me. That's all I do all day in post. Like, when we get there, is look at one shot 500 times until it's correct. And it was just so well done. Like, so well. I know how hard some of those shots are. And to see it all put together so expertly, it just inspires me to do as well as I can do over in my end of the mushroom spectrum.
Thank you.
It was a hell of an episode. It really was. And emotional, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the key of the thing. It all comes back to the script, because if it's just empty spectacle, so we tried to put as much drama, tension, emotion, all those things into it.
You did.
I have to say I'm surrounded by an incredible team. I just have an incredible team. It's like I work with a proper British film crew, like a high-end British film crew, everybody at the top of their game. You know, Lonnie should be directing features. He's an incredible director, so collaborative, so patient. It really takes a whole village.
Oh, it takes apparently a city.
Yes. And now we're everybody's in an arms race with each other. Like, we're in an arms race with the original show. You know, it's like HBO projects are within an arms race with each other. Yeah. And you just keep having to push it and push it and push it. Eventually, we're going to, I don't know, find the singularity or something and collapse into a black hole.
Yeah.
Before we do that, Ryan and Craig, if you'll permit me, I'd love to talk. It's something that's been on my list for a while to talk through. And the two of you guys on this Zoom together, I think, is maybe a good place to start in it. There's this idea that we often have that thinking and thought are a product of language, that basically we have it's our language that gives us the ability to do things, to think thoughts. And I was reading articles this last week about this idea of motricity, that essentially that it's our ability to move is what is actually where thought comes from, that what differentiates plants from animals, and Craig, maybe your fungi people have a sense of this too, is that plants don't need to move anywhere. So that's why they don't have brains. But animals have brains because we need to move someplace. And the idea of moving someplace, the need to move someplace, makes you have to model the future. It has to give you deliberate action. The idea of going from here to there and actually thinking as we sort of, as characters think and as we as writers think, really, that's the reason why we use so many words that are related to movement. So we talk about pushing an idea forward. We talk about getting inside something, like looking at something from the outside. We move forward with something. So many of our words that we use to describe thought really come from motion. And Ryan, the reason why I was thinking about you for this is that watching your show over the last, you know, now three seasons, you never have characters sitting down. characters are always on their feet. I've had other people pointed that out, like, as opposed to the original Game of Thrones, which has a lot of like chamber things where people will take a seat. I'm pressed to think of many examples where characters are sitting in your show. There's a couple of like small council meetings where they're there, but you keep people up and moving a lot.
Yeah.
And so I want to talk about sort of character movement, but also how character movement relates to characters thinking and characters making choices. And if they're not moving, we sort of can't see the thinking behind them.
That's really interesting. I had never thought of it that way. It's funny because I feel like we are a Castlebound show more than Thrones was. And maybe this is my sort of my kind of anxiety thinking about how much we are bound to the castles. Because really it's, you know, I've talked about this show as the original series is this like this sweeping epic. It's Lawrence of Arabia. It's pure David Lean, right? The whole thing. And we have elements of that, but then we are more of this like kind of family saga. I've talked about this as like a gangster epic where basically the Capo de Capos dies, Viserys dies in the first season, and then all of his other capos and the soldiers are fighting, and they all happen to be family, right? So it's this like Greek tragedy gangster epic. Because it's just based on essentially these two factions, the Greens and the Blacks, they are bound to their castles a lot. There's less Western going on in this show than in original Thrones.
It's a civil war within the Targaryen family, but like you're really just it's just these two houses, and you're centered on those two places.
Yes, and the original show is figuring out like who is going to be king, whereas we have two sovereigns, we have a king and a queen. And they are protected in their castles. And so much of the story is based around them and what they're plotting and doing at the time. So I think it's probably my anxiety just saying, well, we're castle bound. So we should be on the move and on our feet. And one of the big reasons for that, thanks to the incredible resources that we had to make this show right from the very start. I mean, I'm incredibly indebted to David and Dan for making the most successful TV show of all time, because it meant that we came right out of the gate with a tremendous amount of resources. I mean, we had the resources, the equivalent resources that they had in season 5. We had coming out. So we've built these incredible composite sets. We have multiple sets that are built on these 50, 60,000 square foot stages where they are built to the walls of the stage. So the Red Keep, everything but the throne room, which is its own set, the Red Keep, you can move from room to room and film continuously, and you're not hiding blue screens or anything like that. So of course, the directors take advantage of that. There's a lot of Steadicam. There's a lot of movement, a lot of walking, where somebody doesn't leave the room and you have to cut to bring them into the next room. You follow them out, and it just creates the sense of movement. So I'm very glad to hear you, a filmmaker, say that, because it's certainly definitely in the DNA of what we're making.
I like this idea. I think this is a very cool idea that I don't know if we'll ever figure out exactly like what the secret of consciousness is, because it's a microscope looking at itself. Mm-hmm. But I do think there is something compelling about how movement underpins a lot of this. Even if you watch something where no one moves, like My Dinner with Andre.
Yes.
No one moves. But they talk to you in ways where you are going places. And and in scenes, I find, where two people are sitting. And I love a good sitting down scene. Last season, there's a scene where Dina has to explain to Ellie, she actually knows who killed Joel. Spoiler, he died.
Yeah, sure.
And in shooting that scene, we really dialed in on when someone would lean forward.
Mm-hmm.
There's a moment where she slides cookies over to her, which is like this. So then micro movements become big things, but there is always some movement happening. I think it's very smart. And when you're directing, it's almost the first thing that happens in the day, because your actors come in and you just start blocking, and blocking is, how are we moving?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it does make a huge, and I think about it too when I'm writing all the time.
There's a scene I was working on yesterday where, because of stuff moving around in the script, I needed to move it from a sitting scene to at a location where it was not going to be possible to sit. And so it's largely the same dialogue, but it feels so different to have the characters on their feet and moving around during the scene. And I had to find different ways into it and out of it, because like, it's just a different vibe when characters are standing at a place versus sitting in a place. Ryan, back to your show, in Dragonstone, they have a massive table where all the council is there to meet. I don't think I've ever seen them sitting at that table. It's always just Rhaenyra at the end of the table, like making a decision.
You gotta look down. It's the point of view, right? If you're sitting, you can't quite see the full.
Gotta see the map table.
Gotta see the map.
There's lots of standing in that room for sure.
But also, we've talked on the show countless times, characters sitting at a table, it's like difficult to shoot. And so one of the great things about character standing is that you can cover that more easily than you can if they're actually sitting down at the table.
Yeah, you still have some eyeline issues.
Yeah, but there are going to be some.
Yeah.
Particularly as characters are moving around, but it's also more dynamic and you could probably also stay in the wides a little longer for it too.
Well, there's something too about the notion that sitting implies a temporary safety. Mm. The person you're with, you are safe. And this is a break or a moment where characters are allowed to turn away from what is immediate need or immediate threat and can become a little internal. Mm-hmm. This is why, even though I really do not personally enjoy shooting scenes where characters are on horses because they're annoying to do. They're really annoying. Yeah. It's just the problem is where the camera goes. It's very annoying. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do. But those are the best sitting scenes because they're moving, but they're sitting. Yeah. And there is a much more interesting, safe discussion. Whereas, when you're standing, there is always the implication, we might have to turn around, run, and start killing people immediately. Yeah. And I like that.
Yeah. I would also say that counterpoint to that is in our sitting council scenes, and probably have more pages shot in the small council chamber in the Red Keep than any other set on the show thus far, just because it's existed since season one, and there are so many multi-page scenes in there. When everybody is sitting, you can create movement in the edit.
Yeah.
Having the overlapping dialogue of the person who's talking, you're not watching them, you're watching the reaction somebody else is making. And then thus you create this sense of layering and complexity in the scene because it's like, well, you know, Damon's ranting about something, but it's not, you know, it's not necessarily what he's ranting about. It's how the other people are kind of side-eyeing each other. And then you can kind of, you know, we're not a cutty show, but you can in those moments take those big static staid scenes and sort of bring a lot of life and movement and energy into them that way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I like to remind myself of that when I'm shooting the first wide. And it's like, well, this is a school play. It's like, right. Okay, it'll get better. It'll get better. It'll get better.
That's right.
So in the show notes, I'll put links to some of the things that I was thinking about as I was putting together this little segment. Barbara Tversky has a book called Mind in Motion, which has a lot of stuff about this. There's sort of neuroscientist Rodolfo Llinás, who also talks about this. The idea that what we call thinking is actually the evolutionary internalization of movement. Thinking is basically just imagining action. It's imagining things. It also may help explain why we can only think about one thing at a time. We should, in theory, be able to think multiple things at the same time, but you can only move one direction at a time. And so we're just adapting that system to do our thinking. So I'll put that in the show notes for people who want to explore more.
I love this. This is really great. I want to read this.
We have some listener questions, or at least one listener question. Anna writes in.
Anna writes, John and Craig, 8 years ago, I wrote in about my anxiety surrounding the decision to quit my salary job and pursue screenwriting full time. You gave excellent, encouraging advice. Since then, I've written several films for major studios. I can't thank you enough. Your encouragement was exactly what I needed to hear in some of the darkest, most imposter syndrome fueled moments.
That's great.
It's very nice. My question is about sequels. One of my films coming out later this year has commissioned me to write the sequel. I'm thrilled, but I'm finding myself oddly tripped up by the craft of reintroducing characters the audience will have already seen on screen. Mm-hmm. Do I give them a character description, even though we've already met them? How much context do I provide for moments from the first film that we'll flash back to in the sequel? Essentially, how much catching up should a sequel screenplay do for the reader, and how much can it assume they already know? You've both written hugely successful sequels. I spent all my allowance to see Charlie's Angels full throttle, no fewer than 8 times in theaters as a preteen. And I'd love to hear how you approach the craft of returning to characters and worlds the audience is presumably already familiar with.
Oh, that's a great question. Well, first off, congratulations, Anna.
Yeah.
It's interesting talking about television and then thinking about feature films because season to season, episode to episode, how much do you need to reintroduce those characters? But with a feature film, there's no guarantee that people saw the movie before this or they even remember the movie before this. So you do need to find some way to meet those characters again in a way that is rewarding if the person knows who the character is, also makes sense if they don't really know who the character is. So it's some degree of reestablishing the premise of who this character is so we understand their function within this world. it's not the same as, we can assume somebody who's watching the second episode of season three of House of the Dragon has a sense of who these people are, but you cannot do that for a feature film.
Well, we also have this wonderful tool called Previously On.
Previously On, it's a gorgeous.
Which episode. Is massively important.
Unless you're on Netflix, which doesn't do it.
Right, because Netflix doesn't want you to have ever stopped watching anything.
Absolutely.
That's their punishment, right? But like on HBO, where there's a week between episodes and then, you know, time between seasons, we have Previously On, and it is important. Even if you're mid-season and you're coming up to an episode, and I have a suspicion this will occur frequently for you, Ryan, in this season, there'll be a Previously On, and it will refer to the things that happened in the prior couple of episodes. And then there'll also be like one thing from season one that you throw in there because it's going to be relevant. And this is something that the nature of our show certainly will be doing that because we are replaying essentially 3 days from a different perspective. It's a lot easier. In movies, you don't have that. So when you introduce these characters, since you're specifically saying tripped up by the craft of reintroducing characters, put them in a context that either is a familiar one for where they started. So, you know, Stu is a dentist in The Hangover. And he's back doing dentistry in Hangover too. Like, you know, meet them where they are and see that they've tried to return to their normal lives, but you can't. Or show them having changed dramatically because of the events, but whatever it is needs to somehow be in contrast or comparison to where they were, and just have characters comment a little bit on the time that's passed. And there should be some bit of overlap, some little piece of something that even though a movie professes to have wrapped everything up by the end, well, introduce that really there was one little thing, one little flappy bit that wasn't wrapped up, and have that kind of be your way into to some of these characters so that not only are you meeting them with some context, but you're also beginning to imply why this sequel needs to exist, which certainly isn't because the studio wanted to make a lot more money. That would be crazy. That would just be silly.
That never happens.
No, that's not why we do them.
I would also say do what I do, which is go watch your favorite sequels, favorite sequel movies, and just see what they're doing and see how those new characters are introduced. Have they jumped forward years in time? Is it the next day? How are they doing that? What are the things that you like that, and then just, you know, steal it. I mean, steal it in the way that you steal it and adapt it for your own.
I think about like the Indiana Jones movies, and it's like they don't have to sort of fundamentally reestablish Indiana Jones, but those initial scenes with him or with any character who's coming back need to have a quality of that original thing that's in conversation with the first movie. So people who are rewarded for remembering who that character is, but can also quickly be up to speed if they don't know who that person is, if they know what their function is. James Bond movies are the same kind of situation. It's who is Q, who is M, what is their function, and we're ready to go. All right, it's time for our One Cool Things. Mine is this article by Amy Dang, sort of a blog post by her, titled, I Solve My Mystery Fatigue with AI. And she says, here's the bold version of my claim. An AI-literate patient running a good process with a frontier model can outperform most primary care physicians for ambiguous, multi-system symptoms. And so in her case, it was this fatigue that she could not figure out what was actually happening to her. And so when she would go to her doctor, they would say, oh, maybe it's this, maybe it's this. And she was frustrated by the lack of a clear answer here. So what she did is actually take the AI out of it. It's just like it makes good sense, which is she was tracking and logging her symptoms. She was doing the tests that made sense. She was analyzing them. But most crucially, she was using that analysis to figure out, like, who are the experts who could actually maybe address this thing? And, like, who should she actually go talk to? Because so often, I think, we sort of go to the first person who seems to be relevant, and they're going to only answer to their limited expertise. So it's just a chance to sort of, what I like is she felt like a protagonist in a story faced with a situation who was doing protagonist-y things and taking agency to figure out what to do next. So I would just recommend people read this, especially if you're facing something where like, this is vague and weird and I don't know what this is. It may be a good place to start thinking about other ways through something.
So just to challenge the headline here.
Please.
Her mystery fatigue wasn't solved by AI. It was solved by a doctor that she found through AI.
It was solved through her taking agency to find the right doctor to do a thing.
The doctor did it.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that, yes, like you can also say, I'm going to take the time to research the best doctors out there with AI or without AI. But I just, the headline is, I solved my fatigue with AI. The implication being AI told me, stop eating this, start doing this and take this medicine, which it did not do in this case.
No, it did not. No.
Yeah. But the idea of I figured out the right doctor for me through AI, I mean, that is the kind of thing that I think AI, yeah.
Yeah. I think we're also often, you and I are often spoiled, and Ryan is in London right now. We have in Los Angeles access to all this sort of the specialists and to do all the things. I mean, Craig, with your diabetes diagnosis, you were able to find the doctor who was like the right person for this. Had you been in a smaller market that didn't have that person, you could be struggling.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so that's why, and so I'd say like, yes, 10 years ago, you might be able to Google this, but like, would you be able to find the right path through this? I think it does help in these situations. And so.
Yes, I can see that completely. Yeah. I'm just challenging the slightly clickbaity headline there.
You should challenge it.
Yeah. I have a game, John, again.
I can't even imagine.
I mean, but I'm really enjoying this one. So, John, you've played Myst, I assume. I don't know.
Oh,
don't,
yeah. I loved Myst. Oh, my God.
Ryan's nodding his head. Okay, so you're so you're one of us.
So they're trying to make a Myst series. I think it's a really challenging series to make.
The book-based metaphysical lore of Myst was not why I played Myst.
No. was it puzzles? Sure. Was it puzzles, Craig, that you loved?
It was puzzles. Not what I mean, no offense to those guys, the great brothers who did those things, but the story was not necessarily, it was rather opaque and not the most compelling part of those games. But there have been sort of Myst-ish kind of things that have come along. And this one is rather Myst-ish and quite stylish. It's called Dimhaven, The Lost Source.
Yeah, I'm clicking through the link. It looks nice. So it's at dimhaven.com.
Yes, and they made Quern, which is another kind of cool game. And what I like about this one is it's got a particularly weird style. You arrive on an island that is in some vaguely Eastern European-ish kind of place. And there's a mystery and you're looking for your uncle and stuff is happening. But what is particularly nice about this, and I find these games really struggle with this, is that they've tuned it to a pretty good difficulty level. And they tell you, we're not going to hold your hand. You have to figure this stuff out on your own. It's got a great kind of level where you're like, what am I doing? And I'm going, well, what if they mean this? Or, oh, wait, aha. They kind of built these puzzles so you get some solidly good ahas in it. So I've made it past sort of the first and second sections. I'm on to the third now. I'm really enjoying it. It plays fairly well on the Steam Deck. It's not really great on the Steam Deck. There's some funky stuff. I'm so happy by having a game 4 inches from my stupid eyes that I'll deal with this with the Steam Deck issues, but it's on Steam, so you can play it on anything, really.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Steam page here. It looks like it's also playable on the Steam clients for PC and for Mac as well. So that,
exactly. Yeah, you can play it on... It would be preferable to play it probably on those than on the Steam Deck.
On a desktop.
Yeah,
you can play it on a desktop, exactly. Yeah,
But then, of course, we'd have... I'd be installing a game on my computer, which I'm not allowed to do, so therefore...
What? Huh?
If I have a game on my computer, Craig, I'm going to play this game on my computer rather than doing the writing I'm supposed to be doing. So that's why...
you can't...
Games are for iPads for me.
All work and no play, John.
Yeah. Ryan, do you have something to share with us? One cool thing.
I do. And John, I know you're very techie, so I'm sure you've brought up VPNs before, but I have a very specific VPN thing that I uncovered over the last year. I've lived in London since 2020, so... a lot of the things that I like and enjoy, sports in particular, have kind of been taken away from me. NHL hockey is very hard to follow when you're living in London. There's also time issues, so I haven't seen a Super Bowl in 6 years. I haven't seen an Oscars in 6 years. That's a separate sort of thing, but I'm sure there are others at work. I use this NordVPN, and I actually put it on my Apple TV, and it's just very easy to, for anybody that's also marooned in another place where you can't get the things that you want. It's very easy to toggle on, toggle off. Actually, I used it for a year to access HBO Max before, because HBO Max just launched here like 2 months ago.
So it used to be Sky.
Yeah. I could not bear to watch our shows on Sky because they put commercials in it and they compress it and crush it to death. And it was just very depressing to me.
Yep.
So Peacock, Paramount Plus, the other things that aren't yet available here in the UK, it kind of defeats the things that look at it. And I'm not stealing these things. I've subscribed to them. I'm just not in a locale where you can get it.
You're busting the geofence, you know.
Exactly, exactly. And the Nord, and it's just, it sits on my Apple TV, turn it on and off. It's been great for watching sports. MLB is really the only thing that doesn't like it, but MLB you can actually get over here with the MLB app. So I've sort of figured out everything other than the time problem of the Super Bowl starts at 1 a.m.
I use it because I'm in Canada and a lot of stuff gets geofenced out of Canada, including HBO. Which up there is, they don't have HBO Canada yet. It's Crave.
What, so yeah.
Well, then I got a Crave subscription, so you know. But so, because sometimes I'm like, ah, well, what did we do in that scene? And I'm like, I can't just go on HBO Max and put, okay, Crave.
Yeah.
What's annoying about our production facility is that their whole, you know, Wi-Fi IT thing prevents any VPN from being used.
Yes, correct.
And so we can't do it at work. But yes, when I'm at home and I want to watch something on HBO Max, I'm absolutely. NordVPN, that's the same one I use. I just put myself in Los Angeles and off and running.
Yeah, great. And then actually HBO Max, in now that they're available here, it's different content based on where you are. So you can toggle between them. Like I was.
Oh, that's cool.
I had not seen Chernobyl. I was alone last summer because we were shooting, so my family went away, and I had not seen Chernobyl since it came out. I was like, I'm gonna fire up Chernobyl again. So
let's feel depressed again.
HBO Max Europe did not have it, and which was surprising.
Why would they? Because
like,
it's a European story. Why would they not have it?
It was just so strange to me. So I was like, okay. Well, so I toggled back, and then I found it. And
you know, I wonder if the reason is because it was a Sky co-production.
Yes,
and Sky in fact paid more for Chernobyl to be made than HBO did. And I wonder if in the split that became something that
they got in the divorce.
They got in the divorce. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Crazy. All right. That is our show for this week. Scriptus is produced by Meredith Stedman.
Supposedly.
Edited by Matthew Cialelli.
I guess.
Our intern is Lauren Losberg. Our outro this week is by Matthew Cialelli. He's dusted off his Game of Thrones outro, and I think he added some drums because there's a lot of new drums in your music there. I love it very much. Also, great. I really like the tapestry, the embroidery intro. Now it's great.
Yes, you and company is YU and company is the maker of our title sequence. They're incredible. Love those guys.
Good stuff. If you have an outro, you can send us a link to ask@johnaugust.com. That's also the place where you can send questions like the one we answered today. You'll find transcripts at johnaugust.com, along with a sign up for a weekly newsletter called Interesting, which has lots of links to things about writing. The Script Notes book is available wherever you buy books. If you buy it in London, there, it's a narrower book, but it's the same content.
Yeah, learn something, right?
Learn something, absolutely. Stop watching Chernobyl and read a book.
Seriously.
You can find clips and other helpful video on our YouTube. Just search for Script Notes and give us a follow. You'll find us on Instagram at Script Notes Podcast. We have t-shirts and hoodies and drinkware. You'll find those at Cotton Bureau. The show notes with all the links to things we talked about today are in the email you get each week as a premium subscriber. Thank you again to our premium subscribers. Craig, why do you love our premium subscribers?
Well, John, they help pay for all of our wonderful people, including our producer and our editor and our equipment.
Our intern, our paid intern,
and of course, the fees that are required to host the show. And when all is said and done at the end of the year, if there's a little bit left over, charity.
Charity, yeah. So we're supporting the Entertainment Community Fund and other great work here in Los Angeles.
Basically, we're angels.
That's what it is. That's
yeah.
Nobility.
Good people.
Yeah. We're saints.
Saints.
I can't even say it without laughing.
You can sign up to become a premium subscriber at scriptos.net, where you get all the back episodes and bonus segments like the one we're about to record on, Dragons. Ryan Condal, an absolute pleasure talking with you about your show. Congratulations. And keep doing it.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you, guys.